Duck, duck, goose! Duck of Minerva in stereo.
This episode features Vincent Pouliot, who is an associate professor and William Dawson scholar at McGill University. He is the author of the award-winning International Security in Practice, The Politics of NATO-Russia Diplomacy, which was published by Cambridge University Press in 2010. And he is the co-editor, along with Emmanuel Adler, of International Practices, which was also published by Cambridge University Press, but in 2011. Hi, this is Dan Nexon, and I'm talking to Vincent Pouliot. Vincent, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi, how are you?
So I always start these things by asking our interviewee to tell us a little about him or herself. So could you tell us a bit about your background and who you are?
Sure. So I obtained my PhD at the University of Toronto. That was not that long ago, in 2008. My supervisor was Emmanuel Adler. And before that, I had done what is called a DEA in France in 2001, 2002. And originally, I'm from Montreal, so I did my undergraduate studies at the University of Montreal. Essentially, I mean, in terms of trajectory, I guess it was quite important in what I came to develop in terms of my thinking and my ideas, that I was sort of exposed to political sociology quite early in the French academic setting, even though at the time I can't say that I was a big fan of Bourdieu. You know, he passed away while I was in France, actually, that summer of, I think it was 2002, so there was a lot of, you know, reports, news reports, and a lot of buzz around him at the time, and that's essentially how I came to know him, and then I came back. But I guess, you know, that sort of experience of studying abroad, I knew barely nothing about Bourdieu before I left for France, and then came back and realized that actually, you know, the connections with what I knew about IR in a much more North American sort of mindset, what I knew about IR could benefit a lot, or at least there were lots of synergies with what I had just learned in political sociology with a French touch. And that's, you know, how I, the mindset in which I arrived in Toronto, and that's how it developed into what happened afterwards.
Well, as is implicit in your answer, your name has become more or less synonymous, and I know there are some people who are unhappy about this in continental Europe, but for better or worse, I think for better in a lot of respects, your name has been become synonymous with the practice term. Would you tell us a little bit about what the practice term is and what your take on it is about?
Well, I mean, the practice term, frankly, can be many things. I mean, when we sat down, Emmanuel Adler and I, and I was in the midst of my own PhD, it was probably around 2005, and made the common observation that you know, something seemed to be going on at the time. You know, Bourdieu was sort of on the rise in IR, but other also streams, right? Foucault obviously had been given increasing attention for more than a decade by that time, and a couple of other developments in the discipline. And so we figured, well, perhaps something is happening right now. And so we've always thought of this practice turn, or the rise of practice theory, as something sort of pluralistic in the sense that it's not one single thing. But in my own, say, interpretation, or where my personal leanings maybe, I mean, it was more in terms of sort of pushing, or at least pushing constructivist theory further in a number of directions. I mean, I had familiarized myself a lot with constructivism as a graduate student, but there were a number of things that I was dissatisfied with in the way that the theory had emerged, and some of these you know, dissatisfying things were quite normal in a sense. To give you an example, then, I mean, I felt like constructivism was way too much about ideas that you can brandish, right? Ideas that you represent in your mind, that you think, you know, thoroughly about, right? And so When I got to study security communities, I thought, well, collective identification, say, as the main sort of causal process of security community development, seemed to me to be something way too much sort of representational, right? That perhaps there was something more practical at the lower level, say, of representation that needed to be unearthed. So that's where sort of, at least as far as I can recall, that was sort of the origins of my interest in what practice theory could do to constructivist IR. But that said, I mean, for me, practice theory is much broader than that. And that's, you know, in the book I did with Emmanuel, we co-edited International Practices. Our goal was much, much, much broader than that, in the sense that what we thought was, you know, here we've got a concept, the concept of practice, which, you know, sort of encompasses a scientific, social scientific ontology that is much, potentially much broader than others, in the sense that whether you're a constructivist or a realist or a English school post-structuralist, there's always a way in which that concept may be useful to you as a unit of analysis, at least, right? And so in that sense, this notion of practice or practice turn is perhaps more ambitious than what I've done personally in my own individual research with. It has also allowed myself to evolve. I mean, when I look back on some of the things I've done, you know, I used to be much more perhaps sort of focused on meanings and interpretation. I'm still very much into that mode, right? But at the same time, taking practices seriously has led me to do things that I hadn't done before, such as, you know, looking at relational dynamics, even positional dynamics, right? So I find myself nowadays agreeing with a bunch of other theories that that perhaps I was much more critical before, precisely because the concept of practice allows me to borrow a couple of insights here and there, to the extent that they're sort of coherent with this practice ontology, right? Of sort of action that is meaningful, but also pattern, also material, wedded in the world, and both a factor of change and stability.
Let's back up for a second and delve a little deeper into the different meanings of the term practice. So let's start with the broadest sense. In this broadest inclusive sense, what is a practice?
Well, I mean, we give us, you know, a definition in the book, but my more simple rendition would probably be that practices are patterned ways of doing things, right? So, you know, when we encounter other people, we typically shake hands, right? So, I mean, it's a pattern of doings, right, that are material. We shake hands, but also have a meaning. And those practices then structure our interaction, right? So whatever happens afterwards is going to be based on how that practice and its embodied meaning and the way, however competently we did it, that will sort of structure our interaction. Obviously, we can still change a lot of things, but so it's this notion that patterns of organized, meaningful behavior are not simply sort of effects of deeper forces or of structures or of rational calculation, that these practices themselves, they do things, right? So they have constitutive and even causal, in my mind, causal powers on further practices and even on the world and even on structures, right? So those are a number of avenues of research that one could explore based on that. But it's, you know, it's somehow you can sort of flip the causal arrow on its head, and instead of looking at what precedes action, you take action as sort of the cause or the constitutive factor of something else, of order, of larger social macro phenomena and that kind of stuff. So it's you know, it's a very sort of, I think, a very sort of, it's something that speaks to our daily lives, in the sense that, you know, everything we do all the time tends to have a practical foundation. It's just when you think about it, the concept sort of brings together a bunch of things, the material dimension of what we do, right, in the environment, in our social world, and as well as sort of the structured and structuring aspect of our actions, which is premised on the fact that we need to sort of have shared interpretations, or at least be able to communicate meaning, right, have some legibility, social legibility in our doings.
Okay, so I'm going to force this down a little bit further. I've
sure.
seen you use a typology, which I've also seen in the literature, which draws a distinction between behavior as kind of, in its most bare sense, stimulus response, right? And then action, which is meaningful behavior. And then practices, which are what on top of that.
Right. That's how we sort of, in the book and in the IT piece, in the article in International Theory with Emmanuel, that's how we try to sort of disentangle the three concepts. But the key here is really that, it's for me, it's a gradation in the sense that, there was something quite interesting, even in the behavioral revolution, if you think about it, in terms of behaviors as units of analysis, and then the sort of Verstehen or interpretive Weberian sort of take on it, looking into reasons as causes and everything. But what was lacking, at least as far as I'm concerned, was this sort of structural aspect of doings, right? That an action is not just agency, it's also somehow structure, right? So and practices that as a unit of analysis allow you to sort of bound up the structure within the agency. And for me, I mean, that's really something I'm not, claiming that solves larger sort of social theoretical problems, but at least it allows you to do research empirically in a way that is both attentive to both structure and agency as part of the same phenomenon, right? It's not bracketing one after the other. It's just a practice is both agentic and structural. And so that's what we were trying to get at by making the distinction with action, right? Really taking fully the structure down to the level of agency and talking about patterns and organized patterns of action with that concept.
So the crucial thing about a practice then is that it's routinized. It is not, actions can be practices, but actions can also be sort of one-shot or idiosyncratic, and practices are not. They're social facts. They're embedded in the world, and they're routine, and because they're highly routinized, we aren't necessarily even aware that we're engaged in them or engaged in the particular meanings that lie behind them all the time. Is that fair?
I'd say that's absolutely fair. That's although that's not the whole thing. I mean, they're routinized, but also they're socially organized, which may also reach a level of reflexivity. I mean, in the sense that one thing that I've been working on lately is the sort of the authority claims or competence, struggle for competence that always goes into one's practices, right? So when we do things in a certain ways, we're always embodied in our ways of doing things is a claim that this is how things are done, right? That I'm being a competent practitioner. And then what happens in social life and in politics even more so is clashes of those authority claims, right? Where different practitioners will struggle for defining what is a competent way to practice that practice. And so there you sort of leave the more stabilized, settled time of routine into a much more political and potentially reflexivized stage where practices and their standards of competence or become much more at stake or problematic. And my view is that in politics, you get quite a lot of that. Oftentimes, those struggle, though, will take place based on routines, right? So, you never fully reflexivize down, turtles all the way down in the sense that it's impossible to start from scratch. There's always a kind of, I think, a practical substrate that, even the most reflexive debates on in politics, but it strikes me that it's a potentially very interesting sort of avenue for research as far as practice theory is concerned to try to understand how in practice the definition of what a competent enactment of a practice is, how that struggle happens in practice. And so I've done quite a bit of work in diplomacy to see how actually diplomats struggle for influence through establishing their competence as diplomat, right, as being more competent than others through a bunch of very, very sort of everyday and minute practices. But at the end of the day, the outcome is influence over outcomes, right? So practices and the struggle for competence are really constitutive of something of a lot of import for world politics when you think of wars or interventions and that kind of rather important outcomes.
Okay, so let's set this argument a little bit. You've already started to set it in motion for us, but I think a good way to set it in motion might be for you to go back and talk a little bit about your first book,
yeah,
which won a major award in Canada and also was runner-up for the most important award in the universe, the Lefgold Award offered by the Mataris Center at Georgetown University. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that book and maybe in doing so concretize further the idea of what practice analysis could look like.
Sure. So it's a book that sort of looks into how Russian diplomats and statesmen and NATO member states diplomats and statesmen sort of moved over Cold War confrontation after the end of the Cold War and started to sort of recast their relationship. And the book sort of tells the story of a very intense symbolic struggle between diplomats to sort of establish the ways in which Euro-Atlantic security should be done. And essentially what you find out is that except for a few moments of agreement or symbolic domination, especially by the West, say in the immediate after post-Cold War, so 92 perhaps to 95, and then after 9/11, most of the time what you find is sort of a clash between diplomats and their practices, right? So at the NATO-Russia Council, say in Brussels, a clash of visions, of dispositions in terms of what it is that this diplomatic relationship should be. So it tells the story of a sort of a limited development of a security community to the extent that there's no such thing as a real security community, right, between Russia and NATO member states, but still there was a pacification trend, right, and it's still going on, I think, to an extent. But and most of the attention in terms of practice theory is explaining it's sort of one focus, one possible focus among many others, I think, of practice theory, but it's very much looking into background knowledge that we call it, or in Bourdieu's term, it's habitus, which is the set of tacit dispositions and articulate know-how that diplomats bring to the table, right, when they meet, and that sort of structures their interaction. And it sort of shows how these things tend to stay with us and stick, right? So it's a kind of agent-based story of pat dependence, if you wish, right, which I furthered then with Ever Neumann in a much longer sort of time frame in another peace and security studies. But in the post-Cold War era, that's essentially what the story is all about. And so the book also has this sort of long theoretical development and mythological sort of exploration of, okay, how do you go about studying background knowledge? How do you go about studying the logic of practicality, which is this, again, this unsaid, mostly sort of below the level of consciousness, practical sense. So I guess that's what the book is all about. It's both a sort of theoretical exploration and then a case study in which I tried to go as much into depth as I could. The methodology is mostly interpretive. I mean, it's based on several dozens of interviews with diplomats in Moscow, Brussels, and then Washington, Berlin, everywhere in the world. In a sense, I wish I could have done ethnography, right, or participant observation. But again, you know, because it seems to me that that's a very obvious methodology for anyone doing practice theory, especially doing practice theory to explore background knowledge, which is sort of this established common sense, the doxa. But again, that was hard to do in the case with the Russians as well as with NATO. And so the interviews are the main sort of point of entry that I could find to access this world of diplomacy and its tacit know-how.
So you talk about this in your book, but I thought it would be useful to hear you talk about it live, which is that this problem that you've mentioned, which is that you rely very heavily on interview sources, and interview sources are likely to give you kind of standard stories about the way things operate, and they're likely to be reflective because you are interviewing someone, so you're asking him or her to reflect on some set of events or occurrences or routines that they're engaged in. And you have a kind of method that you use to try to get beneath the surface of those interviews or find ways of talking about tacit knowledge in the context of explicit verbalization of knowledge. And I thought it would be interesting to hear you say a bit more about that.
No, sure. And I mean, you're putting your finger on a real problem, and that's something that I think, as you mentioned, I've always been quite upfront about, which is that interviews are definitely only second best, and perhaps not even second best, I mean methods to sort of access practicality or practical knowledge. The risk of sort of, you know, just being told, like you said, even, you know, the interview itself is a practice, so it seeks to do something. It's a performance, right? Then diplomats are kind of used to the meeting with us academics, right? I mean, they sort of know the narrative and how this goes usually. So it's something that you need to sort of control for, I guess, when you do the interview. I mean, some of the tricks I used, I wrote a chapter actually, and that just came out, I think, like last week or a couple of weeks ago, in a book on Bourdieu and international relations that's edited by Rebecca Adler Nissen. And she asked me to do a chapter about methodology. So I sort of deepened some of these tricks, right, that one can use to sort of prompt background knowledge through interviews. But what I would do is essentially a bunch of things. You know, it's sort of, I had read, you know, ethno-methodology and how Garfinkel would sort of try to unsettle assumptions by asking questions that sounded so, you know, that sounded so obvious. It's, you know, I don't know if you've, a lot of your auditors must have read these books as well, where it would send, so it was almost experiments, right?
Right.
Send his graduate students to, you know, do questionnaires. I can't remember the exact setting, but then, and ask questions such as, you know, being asked, how are you? And then the response would be, well, what do you mean? How am I? Right. And so trying to sort of probe and then having to face this very awkward situation where you're asking a question about something that nobody reflects upon, right? The meaning of how are you and these kinds of things, and sort of having to deal with that situation as, and as a kind of a way to sort of unearth tacit assumption. So, I mean, that sort of was a kind of an inspiration, and then I tried to make it much more practical or practicable, if you wish. And so I would submit scenarios, say, to practitioners where they would have to think forward, right? Because the problem with interviews is that you ask your interviewees to think backwards, right? Which is the opposite of what sort of the practice orientation or teleology, so in a sense, is, which is very, you know, forward looking. And so you need to sort of put the interviewees in the context in which they're, again, applying their dispositions to real actions and decisions, which is what you're trying to understand anyway. And then the other thing that I would do is really use interviewees as sort of participant observers of their peers. And that works really well. I mean, it's surprisingly, it's not something that seems to be used as much as it should, I think, in social sciences, where, you know, you can learn a lot, you know, about what's going on by asking people to describe what's going on, right? And usually these guys are quite interested. I mean, they're willing to do it, right? Just describe, you know, everyday routine and that kind of stuff. And then the substance, not necessarily the substance, but at least the form and the kinds of interactions they have in their meetings. And so Anne Swidlery called it hearsay ethnography. And I think that's a very useful way to use interviews towards ethnographic purposes.
You know, I'm just thinking back. I'm reminding of the way that ethno-methodology was explained to me in a lecture in a contemporary sociology course I took in graduate school. And it was, you know, the grad student goes home, is having dinner with a spouse. The spouse says, you know, how was your day? And the graduate says, well, why did you ask that? What do you mean? And the joke was that a lot of marriages broke down over ethno-methodology.
Right.
But I think this idea of having people talk about not only the scenario, thinking about sort of forward-looking scenarios, but also sort of talk about the activities of their colleagues is an interesting way of accessing this kind of knowledge. So it sounds like a kind of interesting project and a set of methods that you've worked out. And you say that this is in a chapter in an edited volume.
Right.
And that's what...
Well, there is a bit in the book, right? We started from my book, International Security and Practice. So there I added a bit from the ISQ article, but then I was sort of led to sort of go even deeper, and that would be in that edited volume.
So I wanted to push you more on kind of what practices offer people who are not constructivists, because it strikes me as I get, and I'm very down with the story you told at the very beginning, right, which is that, you know, if you come into constructivism in the 1990s after there's already something called constructivism and there are ways of doing it and kind of styles and genres of constructivist arguments and articles, and you think to yourself, well, okay, so constructivism begins with the premise that the world is composed of social facts, that is, things that are intersubjective, but we view as objective, things that we take for granted about the world, and things that we confuse with natural necessity, even when they are, in fact, historically and socially contingent. And we want to access that. We want to get at the ways in which world politics are socially constructed. It seems a little odd, then, for most of the work to focus on, you know, debates over norms that don't have social factive status, right? Or to talk about things in which people are very self-aware of the subjects of disputation. Hence, again, if they're very self-aware of them, they are by definition not natural kind, or they're not by definition natural kinds, but they're not by definition social kinds that are confused with natural kinds. So I understand that argument very well. I can see very clearly how getting at things like practices would, or at least the idea of the practice term, gets you into actually studying the role and production and reproduction of social facts.
Right.
But I have a harder difficulty seeing how practice analysis, other than as kind of a trope, like we're looking at practices, we're looking at patterns that things people do, and we're studying power politics, how that helps people who are not by inclination social constructionists.
Well, that's a very good question, then. But I think, you know, if you look at the research that's being done right now and that sort of makes use of the notion of practice, whether in a way, you know, that aligns with the sort of more common understanding of it, or whether it's just exploring in a more heterodox fashion what the concept may entail. I mean, for instance, international political theorists who use this notion of sort of embodied competence or struggles or standards of competence in practice to sort of revisit a bunch of issues about norms, you know, from compliance to also the origins of norms. The people who are working in the English school right now, so this is Cornelia Navarri or even Tim Dunn, you know, have made use of the concept of practice to sort of, I guess, harness some of the best, parts of English school theory, which is a sort of historical sensitivity and path dependence and these issues and institutions, but then use that concept to go much further in a way that's, you know, obviously the English school and constructivism aren't, you know, totally two worlds apart, but still they're quite different. Their emphasis goes to different processes in social life and in politics. And so I think this is kind of useful. And one of the best examples, frankly, to go perhaps into grounds that are more mainstream in North America is, if you take a look at the chapter by Eric Vuden in the book International Practices that I quoted it with Emmanuel Adler, it's a fantastic chapter where, you know, from a rational choice perspective, you understand that, or at least so the argument goes, that practices, that is established ways and socially organized ways of doing things, and in Vuden's case at the UN, puts constraints on strategic action, right? And that, and so he ends up essentially, I think it's a very strong argument, showing how both rational choice, strategic action, and attention to practice leads you to a much more complete understanding of his case study, but beyond that as well. So, you know, what I've seen so far sort of, I think, is quite convincing, even say for a neorealist, right? Perhaps to take a hard case, I think that there's this very important neorealist logic, which is the positional logic, right? Where you sit is essentially, you know, to bend it into practice spirit, where you sit is what you do to an extent, right? And that a lot of the things we do depend on the resources, and especially our position in the distribution of resources that we have at hand. And that's a very important, I think, insight. That's one that works really well with practice theory, right? Because it brings back the sort of material basis, whether resources are material in the physical sense or not. I mean, it brings back the sort of material side to practices, but also the fact that between those structural effects and the action itself, we still, you know, in the neorealist or in the positional logic, we usually lack this kind of conveying belt, right? But whereby structural effects actually deliver their effects on the ground. And there, I think you can look, you know, practice theory not only with its ontology, but also with its methodology, right? And the various methods that it suggests helps you a lot to understand the sort of, I guess you could say, causal mechanisms, or at least social processes and dynamics by which structures and action can be related to one another. So I don't know if I answered your question, but I think from a number of perspectives, really, there are lots of benefits that can be reaped.
No, I mean, I think that does cut at the question. I mean, I guess my response or my concern would be that I think if you were to take your standard realist and tell the story to them, they would either say, well, most of the practices that I care about are largely given by the imperatives of parapolitical competition, and the ones that I don't care about are not really that significant, don't really have an effect. So it's interesting to go out and study the way that great power, the sort of expectations and tacit assumptions and basic practices that are associated with great power status might vary across time and space, but that's sort of at the margins, right? That might be one realist response. Another realist response would be, okay, well, yeah, you're right. You know, we now want to know about how domestic politics or intervening factors shape the way that states respond to alterations in the distribution of power. But I'm not sure what all this kind of practice methodology gets me, right? You know, I'm not sure why this isn't just kind of another one of these realist constructivist moves to say that, you know, we should be calling ourselves realists, but really be doing something that looks more like non-realist analysis.
I mean, there's certainly some truth in what you said. I think there's also a way to perhaps put it in a slightly different way, in which, you know, the sort of the historical method that informs quite a lot of realist, perhaps less of a new realist, but, you know, the what we call nowadays neoclassical realism, or for lack of a better word, I guess, but, you know, this sort of interest in the unfolding of history and concrete diplomatic practices that you find in Kissinger and Morgenthau and all the other people, and nowadays in Bill Wolfert's work, for instance, and a bunch of others, you know, of course, you know, these guys want think of themselves as going interpretive, and that's fine, but still, they're reconstructing the sequence of what they consider to be constitutive practices. And again, they may not use these words, but the reason why they think that talking and analyzing these practices matter is because they think that these practices had effects, right? Otherwise, they wouldn't talk about them. They would just talk about the distribution of power. And so I understand what you're saying, and I think that's, you know, there's room for a lot of very interesting debate there. But at the same time, you know, I remember going to a workshop at Dartmouth with Bill Wolforth, and Ivor Newman was there as well. And the conversation eventually was one in which it was much more agreement than disagreement, in the sense that both sides would agree that it was sort of important, whether you're making a structuralist argument, you know, another one, it was important to actually show what happened on the ground, right? And Bill was very adamant on that, and you know, he would, and that's what he does as well in his stuff. But that there was, you know, that the sort of the one lone variable of the distribution of material capabilities doesn't make a good, I don't think he would say it makes on its own a good realist explanation. Then you still need to show how that impacted on outcomes in practice, so to speak, right? And so I think that perhaps there is quite a bit more room for agreement there than what you might have suggested otherwise.
Well, I'm going to be unfair for a second, because I want to push this issue further, which is that your answer gets at, I think, a running concern that you know that I have and that some other people in kind of our circle have, which is, and I'm trying to think about the best way to articulate it, but it comes directly off of this issue of, you know, realism meets the practice term, right? Which is, so we could say, so let's say that we were to pursue a kind of practice term analysis that looks more like what you do, or looks more like what some of the continental international political sociology people do, which is different, but I think that, you know, I know that there's sort of these interscene fights, but I think broadly fits within a broad framework, which is, you say, if you all, and I think this would be true of me as well, were to tackle realism or kind of realist domain, we would say, okay, well, an analysis of practice or relations or fields or habitus or whatever the cognate concepts we want to use, what that does is it massively expands our understanding of power politics, because now we can look at the ways in which power politics is not simply a function of crude material capabilities or a function of you know, anarchy qua anarchy, but is really a kind of a war of position and maneuver in which various types of endowments of capital, different kinds of practices, all meet up to produce various patterns of domination, resistance, and struggle. Right. So, as you talk about diplomats contesting over competencies as a way of pulling rank or trying to get outcomes that they would prefer, and we would say, well, that is the stuff of power politics, right? And
absolutely.
So, in fact, we have this kind of robust practice turn, which makes us go look for the actual, if you'll excuse me, practice of power politics. And you and I think, I don't want to put words in your mouth, we'd be like, awesome, great, that's what we should be doing. And that when you start moving into kind of what you talk about as kind of, and it's easy to do realisms, it's not fair, but it's easy, so let's just continue with this kind of line of thought. You move into kind of realism in the way that you talk about it. Okay, well, let's study how these things actually impact practices, how distributions of power translate into various kinds of outcomes via practice, or the outcomes themselves being practices. At that point, we're sort of talking about a much more there's a risk that we're really kind of talking about much more colloquial use of the term practice, which is, you know, kind of patterns of stuff people do. And at that point, you are talking about practices, but you're not talking about anything that I see that has any connection to something that we would call capital P practice, capital T theory. And so that's sort of where I get concerned, right, in the sense that we slip between a real kind of scientific ontology that opens up new areas of exploration but does have tensions with the way that other people in the field might be studying the same phenomena. And then a way which is really Catholic in the small c sense, but at which practices no longer has any real meaning other than a way of recoding what we would have called outcomes, or we would have called behaviors, or we would have called, you know, our dependent variables, what have you.
To be honest, Dan, I very much agree with what you've said. I mean, I think, you know, even in the book, International Practices, there is that tension you've been talking about, you know, between, so, you know, it's an issue of intention and extension of the, with a T, right, of the meaning of the concept, right, and to the extent to which you open up the concept to facilitate inter-paradigmatic dialogue, you also run the risk of sort of losing some of the insights of a narrower version of the concept. And my own strategy, knowing that that tension is there, has been to try to balance these two moves here and there. And so in some of my writings, I mean, I emphasize the sort of modular definition of practice and the fact that it offers so many handles for so many different people. When I need to sort of where I feel like a dialogue would advance research, I've been writing a piece, say, on, it's in a book on process tracing, and I suggested this notion of practice tracing as a kind of a specific way to do process tracing. And there my goal was to talk to as many people as possible, process tracers who might not have thought of themselves as tracing practices, actually. And so I guess there I'm on one side of the extensive part of the definition. But then in my own personal works, I think I work within a narrower, I don't know if narrow is the right word, actually, frankly, quite probably not, but I work with
more specific, let's say.
Yeah, exactly. understanding of practice, which comes out of Bourdieu, comes out of, nowadays I do a lot of stuff with Irving Goffman as well, who I think is a fantastic, you know, practice theorist, especially for the kind of micro political sociology that I like to do. And so there, clearly, I think I have something much more specific in mind. But, you know, I understand the dangers, right, of playing on both grounds. But at the same time, you know, and I think that's part of the spirit of the whole discipline nowadays, at least in North America, if the fact that you want to work within a specific stream leads you not to be able to talk to other people, you know, it's kind of moot, right? I mean, that's not social science to the extent that, you know, dialogue is most often the key source of cross-fertilization and advancement, right? So I guess, you know, I understand a lot of, actually, you know, this is a comment I've heard quite a few times, to tell you the truth, and I think it has some truth. I think it is totally putting its finger on something important, but at the same time, that tension I think can be productive. And so we'll see what other people think. But I'm aware of it, and I like to play with it, actually.
This is a great set of comments to kind of segue to another level of reflexivity, which is that you're now talking in some ways about the sociology of the discipline, and you're
right.
talking about your own decisions based on your analysis of the sociology of the discipline about how you want to position yourself within the discipline, both personally and then in terms of what you see as being good for the discipline. I'd like to allow, I think it would be really interesting to hear you, as somebody who I think has been fairly successful at that, although we'll get to some other stuff about that in a second. But as somebody who's been, fairly successful with that, and clearly, as you've been talking about, you've been in on the conversation with people who would not, you would not normally expect to give, the practice turn the time of day. And you and Emmanuel have done a very nice job of creating that volume, which has people who you would never expect to be in a practice turn volume, writing in very intelligent ways about practices. Which is a long kind of rambling way of saying. So as somebody who's been successful at that, I thought it would be interesting for you to talk a little bit more about both either that strategy and why you pursue it, or more kind of how what that is as a vision for what we do in the field.
Well, I mean, to tell you the truth, if I look back at my own trajectory, I think I started much more I guess like any graduate student entering a PhD program, you look for a camp for yourself, right? And you want to entrench yourself in a camp. And so if I look back on my own trajectory, I think that was my my natural inclination when I started to write stuff and think through my dissertation and these kinds of things. But then as I was reading and writing, I mean, frankly, it sort of struck me that that was not very productive in the sense that, you easily slip into parochialism in which, you essentially, and the possibilities for innovations, creativity, and even debate are very limited, right? And so, and obviously there, I mean, I have to give a lot of credit to my supervisor. I mean, Emmanuel's been advocating for debate and the so-called middle ground for decades, and so I think clearly he influenced me in that as well. And so both of these things, my own sort of realization that it was difficult to that the fact that you talk to a smaller community actually sort of limits the possibility for not only debate but also for sort of pushing forward some of the things you need to push, forward in your own argument. And so for the past, I'd say probably 10 years, it's been, or perhaps a bit less than that, but it's been something that has concerned me quite consistently that as much as I love to go out with, and have workshops, say, with people that share my more specific, say, understanding of practice theory, and it's very productive, right, because there's so much we have in common. At the same time, I wouldn't be able to do only that. And so I think it's very important, and that was part of the spirit of the International Practices book and some of the other things I've done, that even as I pursued a more specific agenda, that I sort of keep the channel open. And again, it's not pluralism for pluralism's sake, right, or kind of a democratic ethos or whatever you want to call it. I mean, perhaps there's a bit of that as well, right? It's hard to deny it. It's also, a sort of, it's an argument about how, ideas advance, right, and make progress. And I have a sort of, a notion of progress, which is not one, in terms of, better matching reality or whatever, but make progress in the sense of, as our own epistemic criteria for validity evolve, our knowledge does as well. And so in that sense, the tension between different streams of ideas, different viewpoints, and a cross-fertilization to me is really where the advancement comes from. And and I guess that's why I'm willing sometimes to make a couple of compromises on the specificity of some of my pursuits in order to be able to sort of expand the community of people to whom I'm able to have a debate with.
Well, I think that's really good. If it's advice and a kind of vision of how things ought to be, because I know that for a lot of grad students who are starting out, there is this tendency to position yourself in a camp.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I also know that, how was I going to put this? lost my train of thought, which happens to me too frequently as I age. but I think we talk all the time now about pluralism and eclecticism and engaged pluralism, and there's a real risk that those terms become, you know, sort of empty shibboleths to gain entry into, you know, respectability, or that you're supposed to stick in your conclusions of your articles, or that you're supposed to mouth even as you don't practice anything remotely like it. Or it just becomes kind of, you know, to put it bluntly, you know, or maybe I've already said this, you know, kind of a mealy-mouthed nothing, right? And that's not to say that the people who haven't been forwarding these terms, I mean, you know, Katzenstein and Sill and others who are forwarding, you know, notions of analytical eclecticism and pluralism are doing so in a very self-conscious, reflective, and, you know, they have real arguments. But I think that generally speaking in the field, these terms tend to get thrown around a lot as aspirational, but without any clear pathway for how you accomplish this. One of the things I think that's really interesting about what you just told us, and then sort of what's been slipping in your various allusions to conferences and projects, is that a lot of what engaged pluralism may be about is just the choice of individuals for how they are going to go about and interface with other people in the field, right? It's not a matter of what you write in the article, but it's a matter of what you practice.
Well, you know, you just said it. I think, you know, it's a bit cheesy perhaps, but I mean, frankly, I mean, I think it's not to force any coherence on what we've been talking about, but I think indeed, right, that with the sort of the trajectory of ideas and of epistemes and of progress is very much based on what people do and how they throw those ideas around on it based on concrete interactions and these things. And so if the outcome of practicing ecumenism once in a while is that you actually talk to new people and have, you know, new forms of conversations and discover new forms of ideas, the outcome doesn't have to be that you're convinced, right, or that you change your mind. You know, I don't believe much in these things, frankly. You know, I don't think I change my mind necessarily by having those dialogues, but at the same time I expand the sort of horizon of thinkable things that are in my mind, and that's, you know, that's the beauty of that dialogue. It's much less about sort of conversions. I mean, I wrote that somewhere. I don't remember. I guess in a kind of Bourdieu type of pun that, you know, it's not about conversions than conversations, right? And so, but I agree with you, Dan. I mean, you know, with that, this whole thing of dialogue and everything can slip into meaningless tirades, and I mean, there is a real danger there. I guess, again, you know, my own way of dealing with that is to strike that balance, and, you know, between, okay, yeah, sure, I want to have an open dialogue with a bunch of people, learn from other people, but at the end of the day, I still have my own argument, and I still believe that it's more convincing or that it better explains certain cases than others, right? And so I guess there's a way to sort of walk that line, and that's what I've been trying to do, and hopefully that sort of helps sort of avoid that the trap that you've been describing before.
And the flip side of this, though, is to me kind of interesting, which is that, and this is what we were talking about before we started recording and that I alluded to earlier. So on the one hand, the practice turn has really exploded onto the scene. And I think, you know, you're the kind of person who's a, you know, really kind of good guy, and you're very careful about pointing to antecedents, and you already have done so back to Ivor's work or the work of Didier Bigot or Anna Leander and all these other people who were working with Bourdieu or with practice turn kinds of arguments that maybe were more out of Foucault or what have you, you know, way back in the, you know, 20 years ago now, or more. Actually, that is kind of way back in academic intellectual life.
Right.
But so, you know, but it has really exploded onto the scene in the last 5 or 6 years. It's reached critical mass. Your work has been very instrumental in that, the publication of your piece in International Organization, and so on and so forth. So I don't want to, you know, we can both kind of, you know, you can do the humble dance, but I mean, very much, you know, a lot of this explosion is a consequence of your own work in forwarding these arguments. So it's really exploded, you know. And I made that joke when I went to SJIR in Stockholm that, you know, every panel was the practice of the practice of the practice of the practice, and certainly in constructivist circles, there's a lot of talk about it. And you yourself, as a consequence, in part, I think, of both the profile that you've achieved, but also of your practice of engaged pluralism, you know, have been showing up in volumes and in settings that we wouldn't normally expect. You mentioned the process tracing volume that Andy Bennett, my colleague's one of the spearheads for. So that's all really exciting, and it feels like, you know, there's this kind of movement and energy underway. And yet there are a lot of people in the field who have never heard of the practice turn. And people who I sort of have connections with through blogging and whatever, who I'd mentioned, they'd say, you know, what's the state of IR theory? And I mentioned the practice turn, and they'd say the what. I don't know whether there's a punchline to that, but I think it's an interesting statement about our field, because I don't think in the early 1990s anybody who was engaged in publishing and you know, there would have not have heard, at least, of constructivism.
No, I mean, Dan, I think you're right that especially in the United States, right? I have to be honest, and I don't want to target your country and single it out, but I think so far the terrain in which practice theory has made fewest inroads is the United States. In Canada, it's quite popular. I think it would be much harder to find anyone who's never heard of practice theory in IR in Canada or in Europe, for instance, in most European countries, and, you know, including the UK and Scandinavia and Germany and so on and so forth. So, I mean, I think the place where the body of theory or the family of theories hasn't penetrated as far as others really is the United States. And it's, you know, it's disappointing. And I remember Emmanuel and I having those conversations before our quoted volume came out. And we were both very much aware that that would be the hardest part of our endeavor. I think it has to do with a number of things. I mean, it's a complicated, you know, dynamic that I don't think I'm able to explain, but it has to do with methods, right? So for instance, the so far, at least, the formalization of practice theory isn't yet in sight, right? And I'm not saying that it can't happen. I'm going to give you an example that you know quite well. I think the kinds of things that you've done with relational analytics is definitely a way, you know, it's not computation, it's not statistics, so we're still far off from what a bunch of people in American IR do on a daily basis. But I think there's a way in which methodologically, I mean, practice theory can be brought a bit closer to methodological preferences in the United States. That being said, you know, I've been lucky enough to go give a couple of talks in the past couple of years in the United States, and I can tell you that there are a few places that are sort of hotbeds of this kind of thinking, and especially with PhD students, right, which is, you know, as usual, where you hope, you know, whatever you write will convince, right? You know, at your own university, at Georgetown, but I remember going to OSU or even USC, University of Southern California, and meeting with a bunch of very bright graduate students who are not necessarily working under practice theory, but knew very well those literatures and sort of used it either as a sort of, you know, as an inspiration or as a, you know, a foil against which to argue. But still, I think perhaps it is disappointing the extent to which it remains hard to penetrate certain spheres in American IR. But you know, I'm still reasonably hopeful that the sort of family this body of writings can also sort of speak to other concerns in American IR and potentially be part of some of the debates. But I think you're right. Your observation is correct that a lot of people have never heard of it, and you know that's okay at the same time, right? But I think that it will have to sort of, you know, and a bit constructivism was the same, right? It was a bunch of PhD students who finished in this, you know, within, you know, one decade, who sort of carried the torch forward after a few first ideas were written and published. And so perhaps that's what's going to happen. But at the same time, whatever happens, I think there is already a kind of critical mass, and again, especially in Europe, of people are doing it, and I think the perspective has sort of already gained a bit of a life of its own, and that's really good. I'm very happy about that.
So I always conclude, or I don't always, but I always try to conclude these interviews, these podcasts, with a question about what's sort of next on the horizon.
Right.
So, what are you working on now? What should we be looking forward to over the next few years?
Well, I've been working for a number of years, actually, on a book manuscript, but I've had two kids in the meantime and a bunch of not looking for excuses, but definitely it did delay that project by a couple of years. It's a book that provisionally I call, at least for myself, I call it the International Pecking Order, Politics and Practices, which is the pecking order is sort of the practical category that diplomats use and to sort of describe the hierarchy of influence, say at the UN Security Council or in whatever multilateral organization. And what I'm trying to do with that is, at least in social theoretical terms, is sort of harness some of the ontological promises of practice theory to better understand the interplay between structures and patterns of order, orderly patterns on the ground. And in more empirical terms, or at least IR-related terms, I'm looking at how, diplomats are able, through their own practices, to either reproduce or challenge this hierarchy of influence and what kinds of effects it has on outcomes. And so I use a lot of Goffman because Goffman had that very nice notion of the interaction order, right? Which is kind of a mostly evanescent or shifting sort of local pattern that emerges out of face-to-face interaction. And so I try to explore that in very concrete cases. How diplomatic practice, how it's possible that multilateral diplomacy, sorry, is so orderly most of the time, and so that has led me to look at Security Council reform because I want to look at places where the pecking order is being contested, right? So the Security Council reform is one good case. I'm looking at NATO, which is the opposite kind of case where the pecking order is so efficient that actually you can't see it, right? But that's probably one of the key reasons why the organization is so good at what it does is that everybody knows its place, right? Everybody sort of behaves and according to distribution of rank and roles. And so personally, that's what I've been pursuing. And it's a fantastic project, but methodologically, just like most of anything you do with, I think, with practice theory, it's very, very demanding. And so I've been doing several rounds of interviews across the world, and I think I'm going to need to do more. And so that's a bit the drawback, right, of practice theory sometimes is that you would need to be a team, actually. And Bourdieu had a team of researchers at his hands, and I guess that helped him, but it takes a lot of time. It's very taxing on time. But I'm very happy with it. And I guess within a year or two, I should be done with it. And so that's my big project. Beyond that, frankly, I haven't given much thought yet. I mean, there are a couple of issues that I'm interested in. But I think I'm also very much interested to see what other people working in the in along lines similar to mine, at least in practice theory, what they're up to and what new avenues for research are going to develop. So I, again, keep the conversation going. And so I guess I'm waiting to see as well what's going to happen in the larger community.
All right. Well, thanks so much for coming on today. And
thanks for having me, Dan.
All right. And be well. And actually, I will be seeing you in a matter of days. But
Yes, Steve.
hope to talk to you in this kind of a format again sometime soon.
Okay, thanks a lot.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
That was Duck of Minerva, podcast number 10, featuring Vincent Pouliot. It was recorded on September 20th, 2012. And that's all, folks.